John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my rock?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, December 11th, 2012. Israeli soldiers invade local NGOs in Ramallah, and Israel issue tenders for settler homes near Jerusalem. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Hunger-striking Palestinian political prisoner Samer Isawi was moved on Tuesday to an Israeli hospital after reaching a critical health situation. Isawi is on hunger strike for 135 days, protesting Israeli administrative detention and ill treatment by his captives. His sister said today that Isawi have stopped drinking water since 18 days and that the Israeli military was neglecting his medical treatment. Israel's military hold 4,500 Palestinian political detainees, among them about 500 under administrative detention. In other news, the so-called Israeli housing authorities approved on Tuesday tenders to construct new homes for settlers at the settlement of Ma'ali Adumim near Jerusalem. According to sources, the tenders is part of the E1 plan, which is to connect the settlement with East Jerusalem. Last week, Israel announced the new plan shortly after the UN granted Palestinians a non-member state. The Israeli settlement construction drew international criticism. Today, Palestinian president announced that he may go to International Criminal Court to stop Israel settlement construction. Palestinian experts say if E1 plan gets implemented, the settlers' homes will cut off the West Bank into two sections and make it impossible to establish the independent Palestinian state on the 1967 borders. Elsewhere, dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded on Tuesday at dawn the central West Bank city of Ramallah, broke into and searched several non-governmental institutions and confiscated several computers. Damage was reported. According to local sources, the army broke into the women's union in Kaddura refugee camp, the offices of Ad-Damir Prisoners Support and Human Rights Association, and the headquarters of the Palestinian non-governmental organizations network, Bingo, and violently searched them. The soldiers also confiscated several computers, laptops, documents that belongs to the attacked NGOs. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, December 11th news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, Ghassan Bandura.
One week after a ceasefire ended the recent cross-border violence between Israel and Hamas in Gaza on November 21st, the Palestinian Authority followed through on their long-standing plan to seek non-member observer state status in the United Nations General Assembly. The November 29th vote in favor of a new status for Palestine was overwhelming, with 138 in favor, 9 opposed, and 41 abstentions. Although the U.S. and Israel had strongly opposed the move, European nations such as France, Italy, Spain, Norway, Denmark, and Switzerland all voted yes, while Britain and Germany abstained. Among the benefits of Palestine's new status is their eligibility to join international bodies such as the International Criminal Court, where they could file charges against Israeli settlement building in the West Bank or the military assaults on the West Bank and Gaza. In response to the UN vote, Israel seized more than $120 million in tax revenue they collect for the Palestinian Authority. The Israeli government also announced plans to expand Jewish settlements in the West Bank by building 3,000 more housing units. More alarming was the order by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government to move ahead on plans to develop an area known as E1 east of Jerusalem that, if built, would effectively cut the West Bank in half. Britain, France, Spain, Sweden, and Denmark summoned the Israeli ambassadors to their countries to protest the settlement expansion. Your reporter spoke with John Quigley, professor of international and comparative law at Ohio State University. He assesses the significance of the recent UN General Assembly vote upgrading Palestine's status and the prospects for restarting long-stalled peace negotiations.
On one side, you have the statement that was made by the United States ambassador following the vote on Thursday in the General Assembly, where she said that the resolution does not mean that Palestine is actually a state. So, I mean, you have that point of view, which I think would be shared by Israel and maybe two other states in the world, that the resolution does not actually regard Palestine as a state. That is, of course, completely in contradiction to the text of it that refers to Palestine as a state. However, for the government of Palestine, it involves a continuing, you might say, higher level of acceptance of it as a state, which is going to make it easier for Palestine to participate in international organizations in a variety of ways that will assist the people of Palestine. There are quite a few treaties that could be entered into by Palestine that might enhance its position in a rather practical way. One is the Law of the Sea Convention that deals with such things as control over ocean space for fishing, which of course has been an important bone of contention off the Gaza coast, and as well to undersea minerals, which could potentially be important in preserving Palestine's rights to the natural gas deposits that are off the shore of Gaza. There's also an international treaty on civil air transport that acknowledges a state's control over airspace and has procedures to protect that. And that, of course, is an issue because of the flights by Israeli aircraft over Palestine territory, including the drones like the ones that were over Gaza during the recent attack there. But more generally, I think Palestine can operate more effectively at the international level, being considered a state. The next step, of course, would be to membership in the UN, which would enhance its position even farther.
Professor Quigley, the Israelis promised retaliation, and they did, after this vote, withhold $120 million in tax revenue from the Palestinian Authority, but maybe more importantly, they vowed to build 3,000 more housing units in contested areas of both East Jerusalem and the West Bank. And there's also plans afoot to develop land in a very controversial spot that would divide the West Bank in half. What can you tell us about the price that the Palestinians will be paying given this threat of Israeli retaliation here?
Well, it's unclear exactly how that threat will be carried out. Israel has come in for some very severe criticism in the last 24 hours over this. The European governments, interestingly, are getting into the act and calling in Israeli ambassadors in their capitals and making it clear that Europe is not prepared to put up with this. And Europe has quite a bit of leverage because of the trade relations between Israel and Europe, leverage that potentially could be used by Europe. But the threat to initiate this major new settlement development east of Jerusalem, is potentially a very serious matter, and it would, in effect, make it impossible to get from the southern part of the West Bank to the northern part of the West Bank for Palestinians. I mean, it's already very difficult, but this would make it much more difficult. But it highlights, again, the importance of what Palestine may be able to do as a state, because once the International Criminal Court prosecutor decides that the court has jurisdiction over crimes committed in Palestine, one of the crimes that it could investigate would be the establishment of settlement.
Well, just a final question for you, Professor Quigley. It's widely believed across the world that Israel won't bend in any future negotiations with the Palestinians off the hard line it's taken of recent years without United States pressure. And now that the U.S. election has passed, do you think the Obama administration has any possibility of applying pressure to Israel to be a fair broker for future peace negotiations that could succeed after so many decades of failure?
Well, that's a $64,000 question, I suppose. The history on this has not been good. U.S. administrations haven't been inclined to divert. Both political parties think they have to be very solicitous of Israel in order to retain power in the United States, so that even in a second term, the Obama administration is going to be concerned about the next election and whatever Democrat runs. And there are, of course, elections for Congress again in 2 years. So that's the negative side. The positive side is that you did have President Obama at the beginning of his first term seemingly opening up to the Arab world with his speech in Cairo in 2009. And for a time, that raised the popularity of the United States quite dramatically in the region. So he has some sort of precedent, you might say, for having taken action that moves in the opposite direction.
That was John Quigley, professor of international and comparative law at Ohio State University. He is the author of The Statehood of Palestine. For more analysis and commentary on the drive for Palestinian statehood, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Afghanistan, 9th of December. A U.S. Navy SEAL was killed during a rescue operation to free Dr. Dilip Joseph, an American doctor held prisoner of war by the Taliban. Afghanistan, 10th of December. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality from an IED blast at an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, 10th of December. A roadside bomb killed the police chief of Afghanistan's western Nimroz province. His car hit the bomb on the way to work. Pakistan, 8th or 9th of December. A U.S. drone strike killed three suspected militants in North Waziristan. That's suspected militants, not convicted terrorists. No judge, no jury, just an executioner. Pakistan, 11th of December. The Washington Post is reporting another deadly drone strike in North Waziristan. Afghanistan, ongoing. The U.S. military is detaining more than 200 children and teens as enemy combatants in a prison next to Bagram Air Base. The U.S. admitted to this war crime in a report to the United Nations, updating U.S. compliance with the U.N. Convention on the Rights of the Child. The U.S. claims most of the prisoners are around 16 years old. Bettina M. Foster, executive director of the International Justice Network, reports having seen detainees as young as 11 or 12 at Bagram. Afghanistan reported now. In late October, NATO troops stormed and trashed a Swedish Committee for Afghanistan-run health clinic, commandeering the facility to use as a jail and a command center. Iraq, ongoing. At least 3,000 U.S. troops have been secretly returned to Iraq from Kuwait. It is believed their presence is related to the civil wars in both Syria and northern Iraq. This after all U.S. troops supposedly left Iraq at the end of 2011. Mission accomplished? That's been said before. United States, ongoing. The U.S. military is reporting that obesity among U.S. troops has tripled since 1998, with over 86,000 troops diagnosed as obese in 2010. In the first 10 months of 2012, 1,625 U.S. soldiers were discharged for being overweight. It's kind of hard to chase Afghan people up your own mountains when you are not only wearing an 80-pound pack, but also a 30-pound donut around your waist. Mr. Barack Obama, you cannot win these wars. Now is the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com. On the 8th of December, protesters showed up in front of CIA headquarters for the second time in a month to oppose the notion that the CIA and U.S. military can use drones in the sky to kill anybody they want, anytime, anywhere on the planet. Drone's eye view of CIA headquarters. Protesters brought a mock drone of their own on a tripod stand, rolled in as though a drone strike was imminent on the CIA's own headquarters. Unfortunately, that's not how it goes in reality.
Saturday, today, local time in Pakistan, there was a CIA drone strike, and the reports that I've seen this morning, we're told that at least one person was killed. There may have been more, and we're told that this person was an Al-Qaeda militant. Now, I don't know if that person was an Al-Qaeda militant. What I do know is that our government has been lying to us for a long time now.
From the Bureau of Investigative Journalism website. Picture this. Three children who stand surrounded by the debris of their former home a few hours after it was obliterated by a Hellfire missile fired from a CIA drone in the early hours of August 23rd, 2010. When photographer Noor Bayram reached the children a few hours later, he said the children were shocked, but had at least survived the blast. Their father, Bismullah, their mother, and 8 and 10-year-old brothers had been blown to pieces by the strike.
One of the speakers in front of CIA headquarters warned of the dangers of drone proliferation, warning that with the United States having legalized the notion of drone strikes anywhere in the world against perceived enemies of the United States, what was to prevent Russia or China from deciding to use their drones to execute their perceived enemies on American soil?
There's dissidents in China and in Russia, and the dissidents go to Canada or Guatemala or the United States. What would stop them for the use of drones to target their dissidents, their Al-Qaeda, if you will? We have got to stop drones. We have to respect international law. The continued use of drones is a slap in the face to anyone who is respectful of international law.
Rich takes the first
children in rags, welfare reform, let them eat cake. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shopping malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too. See the greed of the shopping malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too. Bye, 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 bye. With pigeons for his children and rags, welfare reform, let them be kicked. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shopping malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too. On the 7th of December, a Texas judge granted landowner Michael Bishop's request for an injunction to stop TransCanada from building the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline on his land. He settled TransCanada's original eminent domain lawsuit against his land under duress as he could not afford $10,000 for a lawyer, then hit the law books with an eye towards fighting back. He hit pay dirt when he found that tar sands oil does not meet legal definitions of petroleum oil. Texas and federal laws define petroleum as, quote, liquid hydrocarbons extracted from the earth at atmospheric temperatures. Tar sands oil is extracted from the earth with hot steam rather than at atmospheric temperatures, yet TransCanada told landowners in Texas eminent domain courts the Keystone XL would carry petroleum products, thus the charges of fraud against the builders of the Keystone XL. Here's what Michael Bishop said outside the courthouse about his case.
All right, my name is Michael Bishop, and I'm a landowner here in Nacogdoches County. Today I filed a temporary restraining order against TransCanada Keystone Pipeline to prevent them from doing any further work on my property until a hearing can be held for a temporary injunction. I've also filed for a permanent injunction, and the basis of the cause of action for the lawsuit is fraud. TransCanada has defrauded the American people, misrepresented this pipeline, and the material that's being pushed through this pipeline, or will be pushed through it, is not crude oil, and they have no power of eminent domain as they have claimed.
The December 7th preliminary injunction stops construction of the Keystone XL on Michael Bishop's 20 acres, but is just the start of the fight. Preliminary injunctions are only granted when courts find they will probably rule for the party seeking the permanent injunction, so TransCanada could be facing months of delay, a permanent rerouting, and more such lawsuits along the entire route of the tar sands pipeline. TransCanada has huge batteries of highly paid lawyers, but Michael Bishop says he is not afraid of them. Instead, he says, quote, "Bring them on. I'm a United States Marine. I'm not afraid of anyone. I'm not afraid of them." Continuing, quote, "When I'm done with them, they will know that they've been in a fight. I may not win, but I'm going to hurt them." Meanwhile, as this is being recorded on the 11th of December, the tar sands blockade elsewhere in Texas has been blocking construction with activists in tree sits for 79 days. They began on the 24th of September and have forced TransCanada to try to go around them. Evidently, they can only divert the roads, not the pipeline, or the tree sit would have been withdrawn after being bypassed. The 11th of December also marks the 13th day of the hunger strike by a group of activists in Houston against the Keystone XL. This is how the Keystone XL will be stopped altogether, one section at a time, and by bleeding TransCanada until they collapse. Otherwise, a prominent NOAA or NASA climate scientist, I'm not sure which agency, says burning the Alberta tar sands would be, quote, "game over for the climate. Tar sands oil is so carbon intensive."
A In mid-November, more than 100 activists gathered at an historically black church in Boston's South End for the New England 350.org Convergence to share stories about organizing successes and to discuss the next steps in fighting climate change after the U.S. election. Sherry Feutlin, who lives in South Central Louisiana, was one of the speakers at a morning roundtable. She's a small-town journalist, blogger, and mother of six children. Her husband works on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico. After the BP Gulf oil disaster in the spring of 2011, Feutlin walked more than 1,200 miles from New Orleans to Washington, D.C. to demand government action to stop the massive BP Gulf oil spill. In October, as part of the tar sands blockade protest campaign, Feutlin chained herself to a gate of a Texas pipe yard, part of TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline project, and was charged with criminal trespass. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who was at the 350.org Boston gathering and heard Feutlin speak about her activism, later caught up with her by phone at her home in Rain, Louisiana. Here, Feutlin describes her journey to becoming an environmental justice activist and her arrests in several states protesting fossil fuel extraction and climate change, both of which disproportionately impact communities like hers near the Gulf of Mexico.
I'm a journalist for a small-town paper, and I went out on a tour that was guided by BP, but I felt like I didn't get the real story, so I went back the next week and jumped on a boat with a fishing family and was really moved by what I saw as real consequences, tangible consequences, devastating consequences to the communities along the Gulf Coast who I love and the area that I love and the ecosystem that I adore. And I really take a hard look at myself and realize what I was contributing to that. And I don't just mean that my husband, you know, working in the oil industry, it's a strange paradigm here, but we have very few choices. You know, we've become so dependent on the industry itself. So part of my work has been to try to bring in green energy options here and try to change the social currency that's here that keeps us so reliant on an industry that is so determined to basically kill us. They don't care about us. They don't care about our oil workers. They don't care about our families. They don't care about our ecosystems.
Sherry Feutlin, when you spoke in Boston in mid-November, two other workers had just been killed on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico. How common an occurrence is that?
You are not going to get a study anywhere out of the oil industry itself. It's responsible for reporting its releases, and it's also responsible for reporting any injuries. Very often, the oil workers themselves are punished in the way that you do have stop work authority, but you can be blackballed for using that authority. We have no unions here. There's no protection here for the oil worker. There's very few protections for the whistleblower. So that's pretty much what happened on the Deepwater Horizon, in that some of the men, even the men that were killed, had said that day even to their loved ones back home that they thought that they were going to die on that rig. They knew something was wrong. They tried to get help. They called into Houston and were denied a voice, let alone protection of their body, because honestly, for the oil companies, it's cheaper to pay for a funeral than it is to set up engineering and safety restrictions that would protect these workers out here on the rigs and on land. That's part of the dilemma that we face.
You mentioned trying to bring green alternatives to your community. What does that look like in your town?
In Lafayette, Louisiana, the Sierra Club and myself and others are working really hard. We actually have two coal power plants here. We're trying very hard by 2014 to get us off of those coal power plants and to bring in energy alternatives. But also an important aspect of that is I would really like to see a co-op kind of agreement so that we can provide the educational and health opportunities that we need here and work industry opportunities here and also community agreements so that the oil workers are able to divest themselves from the fossil fuel industry and go work with something that's going to provide a sustainable future for our children.
I know you've been arrested several times protesting various fossil fuel projects, you know, basically around the country. How did you, as the mother of six and the wife of an oil worker, come to that decision to be arrested?
I was trying to look for anything that would work, and I read a lot about the civil rights movement of the 1960s. I read the letters from Dr. King when he was sitting in the Birmingham jail, and he said that when negotiations fail and there's nothing left, that the only thing we have to turn to is nonviolent direct action. So last year, I was arrested in front of the BP office trying to return the tar balls to them that continue to litter our beach and probably will for the next 30 years, and was arrested at that time for refusing to leave. Not too long after that, I was up in D.C. for the protesting the Keystone XL pipeline, thanks to 350.org, and the climate justice movement, which also has had devastating effects on our communities. We have had 6 major hurricanes in the last 7 years and are still dealing with Katrina, Rita, Isaac to this day. And unfortunately, the southern leg of that pipeline is coming down through Oklahoma and Texas and threatening our Houston environmental justice communities, as well as our Port Arthur, which is one of our most devastated environmental justice communities in the Gulf of Mexico. And so I was arrested there. I think it's been about 2 months ago. But honestly, it's not about the arrest as it is the fact that people in the Gulf of Mexico have no voice, and this is what we are left to do. And if myself, being a mother of 6, have to take one for the home team and get arrested now and lose my freedom for as long as they decide to keep me in order to protect my children so that they have clean air and water and a livelihood that doesn't take their life away, then I'll gladly give myself up. I think any mother would.
That was environmental justice activist Sherry Foytlin, author of Spill It, The Truth About the Deepwater Oil Rig Explosion. Find links to Foytlin's articles and more information on climate change activism on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
On the 10th of December, D.C. area animal rights activists gathered at the Tacoma Park Metro to remember Walt Rave, a Tacoma Park resident and animal rights activist who died trying to save his 5 cats when his house burned down around him on December 10th, 2011. It was felt the best way to remember Walt Rave was to continue his work. Activists staged a candlelight vigil and speak out after giving out flyers promoting veganism. One of the issues Walt Rave routinely worked on, asking, quote, when will they have a right to exist?
Tonight is December 10th, the 1-year anniversary of the passing of Walter Rave. Walt was a local activist. He stood up for animals, humans, the environment, various causes throughout his life. He came back home from Vietnam, disillusioned from the war, tired of fighting, and realized there's something better out there. For most of the rest of his life, he dedicated himself to helping others, to standing up for what's right, to ask the question, when will they have a right to exist?
My name is Kip, and I never actually shook hands with Walt Rave, but for almost a decade, I saw him walk the streets of Tacoma Park with the fox and this lady. Here has the famous Walt Rave fox. That stood testimony to the cruelty of the fur trade. As a Vietnam vet, he served the U.S. Navy. He was grossly disillusioned by all the awful things he saw in the Vietnam War, and he was a promoter of peace and justice for the rest of his life after he was honorably discharged from the Navy. And Walt may have been an eccentric, but he was a very colorful eccentric. He was a brave man. He stood up for principles, and I remember him fondly, and God rest his soul.
Hi, this is Nancy Hay, another friend of Walt Rave's. One of Walt Rave's favorite expressions was, when will they have a right to exist? Because he was very disillusioned, as are many of us, about the fact that a lot of human people, a lot of human beings don't realize that animals have an innate right to exist and that right can be taken away from them simply because people desire their fur to wear on their backs or their meat to eat. And so I admire Walt for standing up for those who don't have a voice of their own and saying these creatures, just because they're not human, doesn't mean they don't also have a right to exist. And that's one of the reasons why Walt carried the fox around the streets of mostly Tacoma Park and other places in the D.C. area also, to let people know that foxes like that paid the ultimate price for human selfishness and vanity. This is what we commemorate Walt for his great heart.
I used to see Walt Rave in the old days when we did the fur protests outside Miller's Furs, when they used to be first in D.C.,
and later up in Maryland. And I used to see him when we protested at Neiman Marcus, also known as Neiman Carcass, because they sold so many fur coats. And I remember when protesters started building up, and you'd see Walt show up with that fox in a trap on a chain, you knew people were about to get some education about the true cost of wearing a fur coat. There's just nothing quite like showing an animal in a trap to somebody thinking about buying a fur coat to show them what fur really comes from.